John Poses, making it swing in Columbia. DaleWileyShow.com.
Talk to John Poses, and John is the executive director and artistic director of the We Always Swing Jazz Series. Is that correct?
That is correct. For better or worse, Dale.
Well, I know that it's better because I'm just such a fan of yours. And so let's first talk about how you started liking music.
Well, I took early in my childhood,
right.
I took classical piano lessons and
right.
Did that for about, 4 or 5 years until I was, 11, 12. And then, of
right.
course, like everybody, I got bit by and decided I like rock and roll.
Right.
So I switched to guitar and made a failed attempt at taking guitar lessons and playing guitar. And I would say I tried my hand at that until, sort of my mid-teens, maybe 15, 16 at the most,
right.
before I recognized the fact that I didn't really have the discipline that it takes to be a full-time or a great musician. And I quite frankly, also I was actually, which is very atypical of me, but I was quite shy and I did not like performing in front of people. I just did not enjoy it. Gave me nothing but angst. And so the combination of factors resulted in my personal musician odyssey ending. On the other hand, I've always liked music, always loved music, and
right.
when I was in college, I ended up having a music minor, but not in the practicum side, on the theory side and research side. My life in essence has music has always played, an important part of my life.
Well, and this was in New York, correct?
Yes, I grew up in Queens, New York, a mere 10 minutes from our outgoing president.
Okay. Did you have any interaction with him or not at all? I'm assuming
no. No interaction whatsoever. My mother was a full-time public librarian for the city of New York, and the branch that she worked at for most of her career was literally a stone's throw from the Trump childhood home that is now up for sale, Dale, in case you have $3 million lying around.
I've got a few million here and there. Who knows?
Yeah.
How did you then get to Columbia?
I always had an interest in journalism, and I graduated with a communications degree from Emerson College in Boston and moved back to New York to try my hand at freelance writing, which I did pretty unsuccessfully, really. It was essentially the equivalent of cold calls. I had no clips, I had no real experience, and I was trying to write articles for well-known publications, and then somewhere along the line I decided I wanted to, that it made the most sense to go to graduate school and get a master's in journalism. Hence, in August 1978, I made my way westward from New York City to the growing megalopolis of Columbia, Missouri, then a population of 61,000.
Okay. And how was that experience?
That was hard at first. Not so much, you know, changing from obviously a major urban center to a, relatively speaking in my life, small town, that part really didn't faze me at all. It was journalism itself that was difficult for me at first, because I found a number of my classmates had upwards of 3 or 4 years at newspapers, and certainly knew the nuts and bolts of journalism and how to put a story together and interview people and get quotes and, you know, all of those things that you do as a reporter. And I had none of that experience, and I felt very quickly, I felt as if I had made a bad decision.
Really?
So yeah, I came within a whisper of just saying, you know, this was a good thought, but I don't think it's me. but I ended up, you know, I ended up obviously sticking it out, and ultimately I got my degree. The University of Missouri has a what they call their Washington reporting program, where you spend your last semester as a graduate student at an MU office, you know, with just a handful of other students who chose to finish their degrees that way. And so I did that, and I think that was a big lift for me, because once I graduated and realized I was able to put a story together and liked doing it, then I was pretty sure this is what I wanted to do. So that launched my freelance writing career, as it were, along with teaching. I did teach part-time at MU for a year, and I also taught at the two other area schools here. I taught at Westminster College in Fulton. They didn't have a journalism department. They had an English department, and I oversaw the student newspaper and, you know, taught, you know, a journalism class. And I also taught at Lincoln University for a year in Jeff City. So that was kind of the start of my Columbia career, if you want to, you know, as a way to title it or whatever.
Well, why did you choose to stay? Why did you choose to stay in Columbia?
I can almost sum it up in one word or two words, let's say, the community. I, unlike a lot of my classmates who got their degree and returned to wherever, you know, they grew up, or they went back to their jobs wherever their jobs were, or, you know, got jobs in different places around the country and moved, I stayed here. During my time in journalism school, I got somewhat involved with the community. Rather than just go to J school and split, I became interested in Columbia and what was going on here. I discovered a community radio station here, KOPN, which I felt an immediate warmth toward, because in New York there was a station, or is a station, called WBAI, which in essence was one of the first such community radio stations in the country. Okay. And I grew up being exposed to that because my parents listened to it, and it was, quote, listener-sponsored radio, meaning people, this is long before NPR even existed. So when I got to Columbia and I, you know, was checking out the radio stations and what was on the air, lo and behold, I can't remember exactly what it was, but I heard the phrase listener-sponsored radio. in Columbia, and it immediately pulled me in. So I started volunteering at KOPN even while I was in journalism school and hosting different programs, eventually getting a slot to host a program and ultimately having a variety of slots over a 10-year period. Everything from a free-form format show that covered all kinds of music to a show that was specifically jazz-oriented. So it was a great opportunity. It was a great skill set. And, in fact, it is what led to my getting a position, the position at Lincoln University, because it was in their broadcast segment, not their print journalism segment. But I had the master's degree, so I qualified for the job, but I also had radio production skills by that point, so that's what got me that job.
Well, of course, now we need to talk about jazz, and how did you first start liking jazz?
Well, that's a kind of fun story, at least for me. After I graduated from Emerson in Boston in 75, I went back to New York, and I did not know, as I said, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I tried my hand at freelance writing, but I had never, at that point, I had never been to Europe, and I decided to go to Europe. I had worked during college and saved some money, and I ended up going to Europe for about 8 months in or 9 months in 1976, which, you know, really changed my view of the world in the sense that your perspective totally changes. You realize, even to this day, how quote-unquote young America is relative to, you know, the architecture, you know, you name it, the civilizations of Europe. So I ended up in Switzerland as part of the trip right at the time that the Montreux Jazz Festival was happening.
Wow.
And it was coincidental. Or half coincidental. I knew it was held, you know, June, July, and checked it out and then made my way to Switzerland. And in exchange for helping to clean the grounds, the Montreux Jazz Festival being the oldest jazz festival in Europe, it was large by then, and it was several days long by then. So the festival organizer offered an opportunity, because the tickets were, even then, we're talking 1976, so, you know, we're talking, you know, 40-some-odd years ago, whatever. So he offered myself and a few other people, you know, young people, the opportunity to see the next night for free if you help clean up the grounds after the show. So I did that for like five nights in a row. And so it was where I first saw, you know, so many, you know, 1976,
right,
were a lot of jazz greats were not only still around, they were basically in their prime. I mean, I saw, you know, Herbie Hancock, Miles Davis, Stan Getz, Sun Ra, I mean, just a host, an array of, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, you know, Sarah Vaughan. I mean, one after the next, you know, every night, you know. It's when jazz festivals were truly jazz festivals. The economics were such that they were supported simply because there were enough people who wanted to see jazz artists that jazz festivals were jazz festivals. Not, they've obviously evolved mostly due to economics into, you know, essentially multi-discipline or multi-genre, you know, festivals. You know, there are rock and roll acts at jazz festivals. There's all kinds of acts that are not jazz at jazz festivals.
Right.
That's just the way they have to do it to survive. So that was really when I had recognized that my interest had moved from rock and roll to jazz. It for me, it was a natural progression. As somebody who had some knowledge of jazz theory and music theory,
right,
it was a natural progression for me. The music, I felt like I had heard everything because I grew up in New York City and every major band played New York City. So when I was in high school, you know, I saw Jimi Hendrix, I saw Janis Joplin, I saw Cream, I saw the Grateful Dead, I saw the Jefferson Airplane. You know, I saw 10 years after, I saw Jethro Tull on their first American tour, Led Zeppelin on their first American tour. So I was able to see the full array of, quote, great rock artists. You know, I saw the Stones a number of times, you know, just, you know, because everybody, obviously, if anybody of those of that stature played the United States, then obviously they would play New York, you know.
Right.
So I was able to see, you know, all those bands, plus, you know, Dylan, the Band, the Doors. I mean, really, wow. You know, an array of the full spectrum, if you will. Of rock and roll. I mean,
yeah.
for the area of rock and roll that I was most interested in. For instance, I was never into the, like, I never saw David Bowie. I could have seen him, but in hindsight, you know, I probably should have, but it just didn't interest me at the time. So anyway, when 76 rolled around and I felt like the move toward jazz and improvised music was a natural progression for me. You know, it felt like it was different. It was more complex. It was more adventurous. You know, and to me, it, you know, to use the cliche, but, you know, I can't think of another way to, it just truly spoke to me. I mean, it just instantly, I felt like, This is the stuff, you know. This is the real deal. So that's how it started in 76. So by the time I came to Columbia, I'd been following jazz for, you know, a good 2 or 3 years at that point.
And also, I mean, at some point, I mean, that becomes, you know, your primary focus,
mm-hmm.
along with baseball, but really primary.
Right. I mean, you know, on the art side, yes, it really did. And I was, while I, you know, was doing jazz shows on KOPN and following jazz, you know, I was still mainly into trying to make a go of it as a freelance writer.
Right.
And after I felt, you know, what I got as much out of MU journalism school as anything was really two major pieces. One was, you can't go through that program and not be able to put a story together. It's
right.
just, it's a very practical nuts and bolts program. It's not, even on the graduate level, it's not like, you know, you might envision seminars and, you know, sort of intellectual discussions about journalism theory. And, and there was some of that, which I really enjoyed, you know, journalism-based literature, you know, reading
right.
guys like Tom Wolfe and reading people who, you know, Hunter Thompson, who wrote about campaigns and the so-called new journalism, you know. And I was very much into that and into magazine writing.
Sure.
But beyond that, the other piece that MU did was, MU was, as Columbia University in New York is, and Northwestern in Chicago and the other top tier journalism schools, they're well connected. So inevitably you come across people who went to the school and you can, you know, use it as entrees, say, you know, mention that you graduated the University of Missouri School
right.
of Journalism. And if somebody is an editor at a publication and they went there, then they're gonna have a natural, you know, not totally, but it helps, you know, the
right.
connection. So, you know, you're instantly connected and you're instantly or eventually you know how to put together a quality story and interview people. So I did make a go of it, and I was very fortunate. I ended up being a feature writer, a magazine writer, and the areas that I mainly concentrated on was music, specifically jazz and blues,
right.
and selling pieces to magazines. But as you know, I have a love for baseball, and I had never planned on writing about it.
Right.
But a friend of mine who was a photography hobbyist and also a big baseball fan said, you know, you ought to try and cover Major League Baseball. You know, and his initial reason was, he said, you know about baseball, and the other thing he says, the publications probably pay better, and he was right on both fronts. So I started, you know, inquiring, coming up with ideas based, you know, baseball based ideas,
right.
and I was very fortunate. I ended up writing several stories for several well-known publications and newspapers. And at the time, the airline magazines were pretty thick, and they were, you know, very, they were still paying freelance writers pretty well. And I did, you know, pieces for, you know, different national newspapers. For the New York Times, if I found a connection, like I remember I wrote a piece for the Seattle Times on Phil Bradley, who was a two sports star.
Oh, yeah.
here in Columbia at MU, but he ended up playing for the Seattle Mariners.
Yes.
For years. And, you know, he lived in Columbia. So I was able to interview him and do a story here in Columbia and
right.
sell it to the Seattle Times, you know?
Wow.
So, you know, it made perfect sense for them to, you know, he was a star at the time. And, you know, they bought the piece. So it was that kind of using, and that was the other thing I realized, even living in Columbia, which you would not think would be a good spot to be to cover Major League Baseball, but
right.
2 hours to the east and 2 hours to the west, you have
right.
two Major League clubs, but it's not so much writing about the Cardinals or the Royals. It's the fact that they're in different leagues. And it means players, every player from every team in that league at some point will visit St. Louis or Kansas City, which means
right.
if you think far enough in advance and you look at a schedule and you want to do a piece on somebody in the who plays for the Chicago White Sox, then you set up an interview while they're in, while the White Sox show up in Kansas City.
Right.
So I basically had access to, you know, every major league ball player, every team. So I did baseball for seriously, and it became my probably eclipsed music reporting at the
Ooh.
Time. I did it for about, I don't know, 5 years, something like from 83 to 88, maybe something
right.
like that, you know. So that's how the, you know, and you know, I did some music pieces though, and I was well paid by certain publications that
right.
That also, you know, were higher end publications. So
right.
that's the journalism piece.
Now, of course, I had to teach myself jazz, and I did not get off to a good start. I
mm-hmm.
started with some Coltrane that was way out there, and I
mm-hmm.
loved Coltrane, but at the time it was not the right album to pick. And so where would you start teaching someone about jazz?
Well, here's my thinking, and remains so today. It's always been my thought. You know, jazz is, you know, you're talking about now 120 years. It used to say jazz was 100 years at the turn of the century, but we're now at 2020. So it's 120 years and change that jazz comes into being. And it's such a vast subject now, and so many branches, if you will, and tributaries of jazz, that it, if you say I want to jump into jazz, it's where, you know, a lot of people are intimidated by it. A lot of people don't know where to start. A lot of people, So my, you know, and at one, you know, at some point, that's where I was, and I have always looked at it this way. I have looked at jazz as you jump in where you are,
right,
and it's a two-way kind of street, if you will. You can go, and you need to take both streets at different times, but you can either go, let's say, to the left, if you will, from the point you're standing, which would be the historical look. You start going back further, and you look at, you know, jazz's beginnings in the 20s and, you know, 30s, big band era, whatever, et cetera. And then at the same time, where you jumped in, the beauty of jazz is it's dynamic. It's fluid. It's always moving forward.
Right.
So you have to reconcile and make peace with the fact that it's going to move forward. So if you stay stuck in time in a particular era, which all of us tend to like the music best that we grew up with. That's the way it has always worked. You know, my parents liked big band music and the early folk people, you know, and you know, the likes of that, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, et cetera.
Sure.
But, you know, if you don't move forward, you're going to be, in essence, left behind. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you have to, particularly in jazz, you have to recognize that that's you have a choice to either, you know, bring your ears, as I tell people, because, you know, I mean, jazz is the reason it's a niche music, and still is and always has been, not always, but, you know, because it predates a lot of the other music.
Definitely.
So it used to be quote unquote popular music. I mean, it's what people heard on the radio. It's what people learn, you know, just it was live everywhere, et cetera. I mean, so you have to be willing to go forwards and backwards basically simultaneously. And here is the metaphor I sometimes use.
Okay.
Remember when you were growing up, because we have climate change and we don't have big snowstorms anymore.
Right. Yes.
But remember when you're growing up, and at least I do, and you would step out of your house in the fresh snow, and you would look to, say, shovel a pathway.
Right.
And when you started, there was no – it was – let's say it's a deep snow, it's hard to even find the pathway.
Right. Sure.
Okay. But then, you know, your shovel hits cement or whatever, and you take your first shovel full. And
right. And
the way you shovel snow is you go forward and you go backward.
Right.
And you gradually carve out the path. And, you know, you gradually take your shovel and walk the length of the path to clean it up, so to speak, you know, to make it look nice, as it were,
right. You
know. So to me, that's what jazz is. You got to just put your shovel in the snow and you go forward and you go back. And here's the other piece of jazz, the other kind of metaphor that I look for. You had mentioned you got into Coltrane and it was fairly far out. Coltrane's large, you know, later works, you know, where he was more dense and more experimental and
right.
and more adventurous.
Right.
But the way I also look at jazz is like a tunnel. And you start at the beginning of the tunnel, wherever it is that you jump in, and you keep moving forward in the tunnel. And when you look back, the tunnel, it's a clear vision. But
right.
going forward, it's not necessarily such a clear vision. You may not know if the tunnel is going to curve or whatever. But once you've gone through part of the tunnel, you know, you understand what's behind you much more easily than you understand
right.
what's ahead of you.
Yeah.
And that too, what jazz is about is bending your ears. And once you start with something and you continue to move forward, you know, at first, wherever you started may not make sense to you. You know, a lot of people over the years have told me, I can't find the melody. I can't tap my toe
right.
to it. I don't understand it. It sounds like noise to me. You know, all these kinds of things. And I'm not
right.
being critical of those people. That's what they're hearing.
Right.
But if you listen to it enough and you continue on the voyage or the trip, at some point it will click in. Not the music you're listening to at that very moment, but you will go back and listen to what you didn't understand earlier, and all of a sudden it's like the light goes on. All of a sudden it makes perfect sense. All of a sudden you can hear the melody. All of a sudden you understand what the musicians are doing. And I know that has happened through the jazz series. It's one of the more rewarding pieces of the jazz series that we have, I believe, impacted many, many people
in terms of
increasing, you know, increasing their awareness of jazz, increasing their appreciation for it, their understanding of it. And so, you know, that's very satisfying. So,
yeah.
But jazz is a progression. If you're a person that allows yourself to be open, if you quote bring your ears to an event, you may not understand it the first time. You may not
right.
even like it.
Yeah.
You know, it is an acquired taste, literally. But if you allow yourself that openness, I guarantee you, at some point, all of a sudden, it'll be like boom. You know, it'll hit you and say, this is fun. You know, this is entertaining. This
yes.
is, and then you're dealing with, you know, as an aside, you're dealing with some of the greatest musicians on the planet, regardless of what the music they're playing. I mean, these are highly, highly talented people that, you know, they may only make literally less than pennies on the dollar compared to, you know, a major rock band or a rock
right.
star, but their skill set is second to none, you know. So that's kind of I use the snowstorm, the tunnel, and the idea of allowing yourself to go back and forward almost simultaneously.
Right.
Back with John in a minute. DaleWileyShow.com.
Do you love music? Do you know about the musical map of Missouri?
Dallas Wayne, Chuck Berry,
Dave Alvin, Robbie Folks,
The Skeletons,
The Ozark Mountain Daredevils,
Uncle Tupelo,
Wayne Carson,
Nelly,
Lou Whitney,
Symptoms Morales,
In City, Jeff City,
St. Louis,
St. Joe, Columbia,
Buckle of the Bible Belt,
Studio on South Avenue in Springfield,
Missouri.
Add the Missouri Music Podcast to your list of favorites. Lawyer, author, and Slewfoot Records label owner Dale Wiley takes you on a musical trip around Missouri while raising funds for Musical Map of Missouri, a nonprofit organization which will help ensure Missouri musicians affected by COVID-19. Visit MissouriMusicPodcast.com for more information. Tune in to the Missouri Music Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with John Poses, DaleWileyShow.com.
And you have to be open. You have to be open to that, because if you're not open to that, then you know, you hear something you don't like, and you say, you know, I have people still come up to me and say, I hate jazz.
Yeah.
You know, and that to me is a very difficult, very difficult, say,
dogma.
It's almost impossible to reach that person.
Sure.
You know, it's like somebody saying, I hate red, or
right, exactly.
I hate, something very broad that,
right.
You know, what do you mean you hate red? What do you mean you hate, you know, I hate TV? What does
right.
that mean? You know? Or I hate books, you know, I mean, what does that mean? So if somebody says something that makes such a blanket statement, it's very difficult if they're not willing to come off of that stance to reach them.
Right.
So,
but at the same time, I'm just so impressed with what you've done in Columbia for jazz. You've made a major impact.
Yeah, you know, this is our 26th year. Of course, this year with the pandemic is entirely different,
right.
And very challenging. Jazz is about bringing people together. Jazz is about multiracial, jazz is about harmony and uniting people, and it's antithesis to a pandemic. You know, live
right.
concerts, regardless of the music, you know, the genre, live concerts are, you know, on hold, on permanent hold until,
right.
you know, we get to the other side of this thing, you know. So,
right.
so in that sense, running a nonprofit, it is extremely challenging.
Right.
You know, we're in the middle of a major fundraising campaign.
Right.
Can I plug the campaign?
Absolutely. Plug away.
Okay. So the Jazz Series is part of a multi-county campaign involving nonprofits of all kinds.
Right.
You know, social services, human services, as well as the arts, you know, all the disciplines. So it's called Como Gives, as in Columbia, Missouri Gives, but it's actually, there are seven or eight counties in the central Missouri region that
wow.
that are involved. And it's run by a nonprofit, but a startup known as the Community Foundation of Central Missouri.
Okay.
And you know, it's like a lot of cities have their own foundations. There's a Kansas City Foundation,
right.
there's a St. Louis Foundation, et cetera. This one covers, like I said, seven, eight counties in central Missouri, and they administer in December a campaign for all the nonprofits, for the nonprofit sector, if you will. So there's 140 something organizations participating, and
right.
it's an online only campaign. The idea of getting people, and it's very simple to contribute. You every organization has its own page on the Como Gives website. And for people who want to contribute to the Jazz Series, it's just you can, there are pull down menus. You look up We Always Swing Jazz Series, you get to our page, and you can make a donation. The minimum donation is only $10. So
okay.
it's not like you got to contribute gobs of money to contribute.
Right. Sure.
So, and our campaign this year, actually, which impacts all of your listeners,
right.
We decided that we would run a campaign this year called States United through jazz.
Okay.
Meaning it's a play on the words, obviously, but instead of having, in this election year, having red states and blue states,
right,
we came up with a map, or a map of the United States, and also a map of Missouri by county.
Wow.
And the idea is people, we want to bridge, we want to use the jazz series to bridge people together, you know, to unite people.
Right.
So as people contribute from a different state or a different Missouri county, that particular state or county begins to turn shades of green.
Right.
And so, and our web guide built it in so there's at least seven shades of green. So anytime, what county are you in? I'm sorry, I don't know.
Stone County.
What county?
Stone County.
Oh, Stone. So if somebody from Stone County contributes to the jazz series, that county will start to turn green. And as more people contribute from that county, regardless of the amount, I mean, if one person contributes $1,000, it turns one shade of green. If one person contributes $10, it will turn the same shade of green, unless it's the second contribution
right.
from that county, then it turns dark, you know, slightly darker. So if you go to the Jazz Series website, not the Como Gives page, but
right.
our actual website, which is wealwaysswing.org, you can click, there's a one click through, and you will, as we like to tell people, see the maps. And right,
right
now, we're, you know, this is a month-long campaign. So today is December 12th, day 12. So far, we have received at least one contribution from 21 or 22 states.
Wow.
Which is pretty good. Last year we did it. We got to 33 states. We're hoping, obviously, to surpass that. And as far as the counties are concerned, ironically, it's been a little bit tougher sledding to get counties to contribute.
Right.
But of course, Dale, I know you will once we hang up.
I sure will. Absolutely. No doubt.
So anyway, I think we're up to 9 or 10 of Missouri's 114 counties.
Okay.
So but, you know, if you go to our website, you'll see the maps. And the reason we do it also, we have donor tickers that are like stock market tickers, one for the
right.
states and one for the counties. So when somebody donates their amount, we don't use names. So, you know, we use dates when they contributed and where they contributed from and the amount that was contributed.
Right.
And it's like a scroll, like the weather scroll or a stock ticker. So
right.
we try to have fun. So the maps are interactive, as are the donor tickers. And you can hover over the states and the counties, and you can see how many people have given a total of how much money in a given state or a given county. So
right.
so we try to make the campaign fun, and we send out emails every day updating the maps, updating, the campaign. And, you know, we're about halfway to our goal, which is 62,000. We've raised 31 or 2,000. So we're literally pretty much right at the halfway mark.
Wow.
So that's, you know, it started on the 1st and it goes till New Year's Eve at midnight when the faucet turns off, so to speak, you know, and they,
right.
they kill the web page or the website. So, I hope some of your listeners will, contribute. And again,
yeah.
And if people want to, we really like it, aside from contributing, if you can't contribute, that's fine. But people, we like people to sign up for our email list.
Yeah.
And if they go to our website, right on the homepage, there's a spot where people can you know, sign up. And if they go to wealwaysswing.org, there's a spot on the homepage where it says sign up for our email.
Right.
And we want to encourage people to do that. So that's the We Always Swing Jazz series. Our our mission is simply to present, promote, preserve, and celebrate the great global art of jazz. That's it in a nutshell. And we've been very fortunate. As I said, this is the 26th year. We've probably had 300 plus concerts featuring the world's greatest artists. You know, Dave Brubeck's been here. Herbie Hancock's been here. Right. Pat Metheny's been here.
All the good ones.
What's that?
All the good ones. All the live good ones have been there.
Yeah. You know, not everyone, but a lot of them, you know. And we have a – and the other thing that we feel good about is even though we're located – you know, in a relatively small market, and Columbia has more than doubled since I got here.
Right.
You know, people around the country know about the Jazz Series, and there's two reasons for that. One is good, and one is not so good.
Okay.
The good one is because people have heard of us over 20. We've had staying power, and
right.
Because jazz is not in every town, unlike, let's say, rock and roll, which is in every town.
Right.
So by default, people have heard of the Jazz Series on the East Coast and the West Coast, you know, everywhere.
Right.
And so that's very rewarding, obviously, and they consider it a quality project. The downside of it is the fact that, the truth be told, there's not enough of us in the country. There's not, like, you can't go to every college town,
right,
and have a serious jazz program. You can go to every college town and you will find a pretty good rock scene, a pretty good rock venue, you know, et cetera.
Right.
So if you're in a rock and roll band, you can crisscross this country forever almost.
Right.
But if you're a jazz artist, there's only so many opportunities to do that. And so that's the downside. We are known in part because of our staying power, but we're also known in part because we're respected within the field for being a good presenter, you know,
right.
A respectful presenter, a serious presenter. So it's kind of a double-edged sword is what it is. So,
well, that's so fun. And again, I think that all you've done, you're such a good arts curator. You just the way you present it is amazing.
Well,
but now let's talk about my project, the Musical
okay.
Map of Missouri. And
okay.
So give me some names.
What's that?
The Musical Map of Missouri. Who are some names that people need to know about jazz at Missouri?
In Missouri, okay. Well, we just did a project in the fall, one concert a month, featuring regional artists, and
okay.
We will because of the pandemic, nobody's really traveling by air, nobody's
sure.
really touring, so we decided we would do either a combination of live streams, pre-produced streams that we would then air. Or in person with very limited attendance, socially
okay.
distanced, adhering
right.
to all the guidelines, but also live streaming it. So we did that last version with four shows where we had all of 36 people allowed to attend,
okay.
and we featured a group. A wonderful guitarist from St. Louis, Eric Slaughter, who actually brought with him a drummer named Marty Morrison, who is based in Springfield,
okay.
And an organ player was also in the group. He was actually from Omaha, Nebraska. But again, these are regional artists that can, you know, come in and leave this the same day. You know, they're not on tour. We
right.
also featured a wonderful younger baritone saxophonist out of Kansas City, a woman named Ariana Nemati, Nemati.
Okay.
And she attended both MU and UMKC, and she had a quartet, and the quartet consisted of a pianist I was unfamiliar with, but very good, from Kansas City. I believe his name was Brad Ward, W-A-R-D, I think.
Okay.
Don't hold me to that, but I know the other two, the other two members of the band were, the drummer was a gentleman by the name of Brian Stever, S-T-E-E-V-E-R, and he grew up in Jeff City and lives in Kansas City now, and he's a very good drummer. And the bassist actually came to MU to study jazz music, music and jazz in, through MU, named Sam Copeland, and he now lives in Kansas City, and he went through the UMKC program there. So he grew up in Columbia. So he it was a homecoming for him of sorts. And Brian Stever lived in grew up in Jefferson City, even though he's in Kansas City. So again, we did this regional. There are a great many artists, and I'm not talking about people who were born in St. Louis or born in Missouri and no longer live here. We're talking about there is a very good regional scene in Missouri, and then in as well as the surrounding states, but you know, Columbia itself has a pretty good local jazz scene, with the Hennessy brothers being one. Sean Hennessy is a very good guitar player. Kevin, his brother, is a bassist. A gentleman by the name of Tony Lotven, L-O-T-V-E-N, is a saxophonist and flute player. I guess our most or best known local player here is a pianist by the name of Tom Andes, who has been playing, you know, he's a Berklee School of College of Music graduate, and you know, came back to Missouri to raise his family and live in Springfield. The program at the university there is run by a really good alto saxophonist named Randy Hamm.
Yes.
And you know, so they're just, you know, in the world of jazz, as we like to say, and really it pertains to any quote celebrity kind of status, if you will, or standing. Everybody is from somewhere, you know. I mean, you don't grow up in New York and become a, you know, like most of the New York jazz musicians are, who then go on as a springboard, go on to become internationally known. Most of them arrive to New York from somewhere else. You know, it's not like they're native. I mean, that's been the history of jazz. I mean, Louis Armstrong's from New Orleans, you know, and Count Basie is from, you know, Kansas City, and Duke Ellington was from Washington, D.C., and, you know, on and on and on. And just New York became the epicenter, and still is, of jazz. But, you know, Pat Metheny is from Kansas City, you know.
Right, exactly.
You know, I should mention that really one of the great saxophonists of the last 40 years has returned to Kansas City, and that's Bobby Watson, who had gone to the University of Miami, then went to New York and played for 25 years, used New York as the base to play with Art Blakey, to play with, you know, you name it, and to lead his own bands. And then he was asked to return to UMKC run the jazz studies program there starting in 2000. And he did that for 20 years. He has just retired, and he stayed in Kansas City. So here we have one of the preeminent jazz artists over the last 40 years living in Kansas City, or I guess he's right on the Kansas side of Kansas City. So you know, there the musical map, the jazz musical map specifically in Missouri is pretty healthy, actually.
It definitely is.
And that's also very satisfying. As far as the jazz series is concerned, I like to think that, you know, we've had something to do with it, or we certainly have augmented it, not to pat ourselves on the back, but it's really, you know, if we can serve the jazz community as a catalyst and a point of contact and et cetera, then that's, again, very satisfying.
Well, and specifically, in thinking about this, I so remember seeing Claude Fiddler Williams at your shows.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's no longer with us, but,
right.
We've had people like that and, historically great musicians, coming here, from Kansas City or St. Louis or, wherever. So, I mean, the point is, if you're a good player, you're a good player. If you're,
right.
And like I say, everybody's from somewhere, it's not like you have to be born in Chicago, New York, LA, San Francisco. You don't have to come from a big city, you have to, what you do is have to have talent,
Right.
And that's the common denominator with all the players.
Well, one question for you is,
would you
represent Kansas City with Count Basie or Bird?
Well, I don't think it's an either or. There's so many great, there's so many great musicians that, Kansas City was home to Jay McShann. Kansas City was home to Bird. Kansas City was home to Basie, Lester Young, Coleman Hawkins was from St. Joe.
Right.
I mean, there's so many. I mean, Kansas City was this burgeoning, one of the true centers during, during the 30s, 40s. Mary Lou Williams, the great pianist, spent a great deal of time in Kansas City before she left. I mean, to me, it's not an either or,
Right.
I mean, there's probably 20 to 30 historically significant figures who are Kansas City natives. There may be more,
right.
too, but I know there's at least that many. So,
yeah.
It's not so much who's better than whom, a lot of times jazz gets caught up on polls, like who's the best this
right.
or that or whatever. And I've never been a big fan of polls. I've been asked to participate in them, for any number of years, dating to like my writing days, a lot of writers end up, being part of polls. And I have all but, I can't remember the last poll I participated in, because I think to say there are only five great saxophonists is ludicrous, I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's in essence a popularity contest.
Right.
And so what, I mean, it's not where I get much satisfaction.
Right.
So,
I totally get that.
So,
but that's why it's so fun to talk to you I enjoyed it very much.
Well, Dale, I appreciate the invitation.
Yes.
I know your thousands upon thousands of listeners will head right away to Como Gives, COMOGIVES.com, and contribute to the jazz series.
Oh, absolutely.
And we will thank them profusely for doing
yes.
so. And of course, Dale, if you're, if once, please have your listeners truly sign up for our email.
Sure.
We send out a weekly what we call our e-note normally, but in December we do it daily because of the fundraising campaign.
Right.
So anybody who wants to sign up and learn more about the jazz series, and if people are visiting Columbia, we have a really nice downtown space right in the heart of Columbia on 10th Street, and we have a 9,000 plus CD LP collection that's open to the public, and a library, you know, a literature library filled with magazines and books on jazz, and it's where our box office is. And of course, we have the proverbial merch available to people.
Right. No doubt. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Dale, thank you for the invite, and I enjoyed talking with you, and I hope, you know, people got something from it. And anybody who wishes to contact us, again, the email is info@weswing.org. So there's two S's there, always and swing.org.
Thanks
okay?
so much.
Thank you, Dale.
DaleWileyShow.com.